Welcome to this podcast of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton, the founder of Climate One. Today, our topic is India. India comes up quickly in any conversation of global carbon emissions and reductions, the world's fifth largest emitter. And today, we have two experts with us to discuss India and climate change and clean energy. Varun Rai is a research fellow in program on energy and sustainable development at Stanford University. And Alexis Ringwald is co-founder of Valence Energy and a former Fulbright scholar in India. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, Varun, let's start with you and give us the big picture. India is often seen as a country that's more reticent to make mandatory commitments or reductions. So where are they? We're a couple months going into Copenhagen. And what's India's position with regard to sort of the big geopolitical picture on what they're willing to do on climate change?
Sure. India's position going into the climate change negotiations at Copenhagen are, I think, pretty much what we knew a few years ago, which is no mandatory emission cut. In fact, they're not very willing to talk about that. What has changed, though, for good, is their willingness to actually come ahead and do something, talk about positive things. And these can be either energy efficiency, demand reduction, and more efficient coal plants and things like that. So now the thinking in India is more about per capita emissions plus, and this plus is a whole range of other things that India could do, which are both in its own interest as well as are also climate friendly. So that is where it is.
And when you say per capita, that's referring to statements by Prime Minister Singh, who said we will not go above the world average per capita. Of course, now India is way below. So if some people are concerned, if they go to the world average per capita, that's still a tremendous increase.
Yes, and one thing, so there are two things on that. First of all, that discussion, that international discussion of what that cap has to be, what that equity means. This generally comes under the umbrella of equity of climate change or equity of global environment. How do you share that? That discussion is very much active, and there is no solution. So I don't think that even that will be discussed at Copenhagen, but I don't see any solution at this stage, not because India is the big problem, but because there is no global consensus on that. What that still means in terms of per capita emissions is, for example, the 2 degree to limit global climate change to 2 degrees, the world has to reduce its emissions by 50%. And that means that developed countries have to reduce by 80%. So these are, you know, general numbers.
Sure, by 2050. Yeah.
By 2050. Now, for example, for the United States, reducing 80% from its current per capita of 20 million tons per year, that brings you down to 3-4 million tons. And for India, even that is very aggressive.
Meaning, you know, India is at about 1 ton now.
Yes, but, you know, 2050, they are probably looking at 4 or 5 million tons. So, you know, it's not... It's what I'm trying to convey is, from India's perspective, even that statement from the Prime Minister generated a big discussion within the country, whether how could you go ahead and say that? Meaning it's not something without any commitment. It's not as simple to even say that we'll not never exceed, because if really there's global action on emissions reductions, if developed countries can reduce by that much, I think even with that statement, India has already committed something.
And we'll get to Alexis in a minute. There seems to be some, or you tell me, some softening or some openings recently, some statements by the Prime Minister and the Environment Minister saying, well, India doesn't want to be a spoiler or be the bad boy. Is it correct to say there might be some softening or openings as we get a little bit closer to Copenhagen?
Absolutely. There's no question on that. And both because it's the primary two reasons for that. First, that countries like China and Mexico or India is seeing these countries breaking out a little bit, so India is concerned. India doesn't want to be left out from them, so that's one reason. The second reason, I think, which is more to do with India's own image in terms of global climate change discussions, is so far India has been seen as this spoiler. And both Indian intellectuals as well as intellectuals around the world, people, policymakers, they have pointed to India, look, there are so many things you're already doing, there are so many things you can do, are climate friendly. Why didn't you just try to start focusing on those things, include those things in the discussions, doesn't hurt you. So these two things have come together, and most definitely at the top level, it has made a softening of that stand.
Interesting that there's actually a little bit of competition among the developing nations.
Absolutely.
Sort of healthy competition because it's for jockeying for position. Alexis, when you and I met in Delhi last year, you had just finished driving a caravan of renewable and, I believe, electric-powered vehicles across India to make the point that it's possible. So what do you see as an entrepreneur that's been working on the ground in terms of what kind of green shoots are popping up on the ground in India?
Yeah, so in January of this year, we traveled from Chennai to Delhi, about 2,500 miles in these solar plug-in electric cars. They're Indian-made from a group called Reva in Bangalore. I was a Stanford graduate, and they have investment from the U.S., and it's an exciting technology. We traveled to try and document the top solutions to climate change, and we found things all over the country, including just simple things, traditional practices in India that I think are inspiring and that should be replicated in the West, like banana leaf plates or rainwater harvesting projects. We also saw...
Hold on. What, banana leaf plates?
Yeah. So instead of using styrofoam, you could just use a banana leaf plate.
And okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, to eat off of. And simple things like that. And then also more advanced things that were happening at the universities that we visited where they were developing solar robots and other kind of more sophisticated technologies by entrepreneurs and university graduates that I think show hope and show promise that things are already happening on the ground in the country.
So who's going to solve this? We often have this debate here in Silicon Valley in the U.S. whether this really ought to be a policy-led effort, that policy needs to be set in place first. And other people say, look, government ought to get out of the way. Technology, innovation, perhaps with some government funding, could really make a dent in the climate problem. So which do you think it is? Alexis?
I mean, I see out of India, there's 500,000 engineering graduates coming every year. And that is a powerful testament to the fact that there are engineers who and others who are ready to be harnessed to develop these technologies. I think kind of putting in the right policy frameworks and some government R&D money towards setting up centers and encouraging universities to develop these locations, these incubators, could go a long way in fostering the entrepreneurship there.
And Varun, what do you think? I mean,
yeah, I think when talking about scale, you know, you really have to have the right policies in place. And a lot of the things that the universities are doing, that engineers are trying to do in terms of green technology, these are both in terms of interest because they learn about these things globally and also about just waiting for something to happen in the future so that can be taken advantage of in terms of business. But really to make the difference, you have to have the right policy. So I think that is very, very important. And if you look at other places across the world, be it Europe or California, there have been entrepreneurs have played a big role, but that has come piggybacked on good, friendly policies as well.
But good, friendly policies often in the eye of beholders, and they take a long time, especially in messy democracies like India or the United States. So what do you say to people who say, look, we got to get going on this fast, and government's taken too long to decide and study and you know, go through the deliberative process? Meanwhile, Rajendra Pachauri, who is obviously based in Delhi, says the developed countries have 6 years for emissions to peak. We don't have a lot of time to do policy studies and get things in place. We need action now.
Well, the thing is, you know, how do you get paid for it? For example, if I'm a green entrepreneur, if I have to go around and set up gigawatts worth of solar plants, I need that assured demand. I need to make sure that I get paid for it. And all my good intentions of reducing global warming come to nothing so long as ultimately, I get paid for it. So be it today or tomorrow, you do need the policies. That is where really the money comes from, I think.
And let's pick up on that, because how many people in India have no reliable access to any electricity, energy poverty in India?
Well, no access to modern energy sources, about 50% of the population. That's about 500 million. And talking about reliable energy, that number goes up higher. It's about 700 million people do not have access to reliable energy.
And you've written about how India's primary goals, obviously, are economic development, first and foremost, getting energy and other basic needs to those people, and reductions is kind of a luxury down the road, right? So how can they – what's happening in terms of electricity reform and pricing that might, A, get electricity to those people and also provide pricing incentives for cleaner electricity rather than coal, which provides most electricity in India?
Absolutely. That's a very important point. Just to give some numbers, over a third of the electricity generated in India is stolen, meaning it is generated and people either just use it for household consumption or also some industries and companies also steal it. Now, what it means is you do not have any control over the pricing of that, meaning you cannot expose that part of the demand to demand reduction or price signals. Now, that's very inefficient when you try to put on solar or gas on the grid or nuclear on the grid. It's still being stolen. So you see you don't have that price flexibility. The first and foremost thing that India really needs to do is to make its grid system, distribution system, very efficient. And some of the states in India has already done that. India has a national policy that was put in place in 2003 called the Electricity Act of India, which tries to incentivize some of the states to do that. The things that you mentioned about democracy and time-taking, that's exactly what has come in the way. So there are a lot of the states have not still done much, but few states, for example, Gujarat, Delhi, Tamil Nadu, they're doing pretty good on reducing the losses. To take the case of Delhi, it has reduced its losses from 50% of stolen electricity down to 25% in 5 years. And we have done run some numbers. If you can take that type of efficiency gains across India, that means emissions reductions of about 250 million tons per year in 10 years. And put that number in perspective, the entire European carbon market is about 340 million tons. So, you know, if you can improve the efficiency, not only do you need less generated power,
sure, that's a big
not only can you reach more poor people, but also you just reduce the emissions by so much.
Well, buildings is another area where there's great opportunity for efficiency, both in the United States and in India. And Alexis, you were recently at a green building conference. So what's happening in India in terms of energy efficiency, both of existing buildings as well as new ones?
Yeah, I think existing building owners, you know, hotel chains and retail chains find that the grid is pretty unreliable and that they have to rely on diesel generators on site. So for them, energy is a huge expense because they're running a significant portion of the day on these diesel generators, of which sometimes the cost of running is about four times more per kilowatt hour in cost than running off the grid. And so I think there are increasingly efforts and interest, not only to smarten the grid, which is what Varun was talking about, I find incredibly important, but also to smarten buildings up so they're not consuming so much and so that they are aware of which source they're running on and they're aware of what they're paying at that given moment.
It's often thought, although some people debate this, that there's actually a premium for green building or efficiency. I mean, can India afford to pay the extra 1% or 2% or 3% to, or do they have the cost incentives in place to recapture that over the life of a building?
I don't even know why it should be more expensive because I find in traveling across the country, I found beautiful green buildings from historical eras in which the traditional architecture was more green than what you see today. And I think now there's an awareness of going back towards recognizing using local materials and natural cooling systems, which they had in their earlier former Maharaja palaces, rather than building purely glass, office greenhouse buildings. And so I think that's something we can all learn from.
Back to basics. You mentioned coal earlier, Varun, and we need to talk about coal because, as I said, 60% of, I believe, of India's electricity comes from coal. You've written about supercritical, I'm not really sure what that means, but highly efficient coal plants. And is there really any path, any avoiding in India really just consuming more coal, and which accounts for a tremendous portion of global greenhouse emissions?
So on coal right now, the message for India is good and bad. The good message is, contrary to conventional wisdom, India does not have much coal. At production rates, let's say production rates of what the production rates will be in 2020, India has reserves for at most four to five decades. So India is extremely concerned about that, and that is where India's own interests of its energy security aligns well with climate change, because India is having to think about alternatives to coal, for example, in terms of nuclear. India is really looking ahead, not in terms of deployment right now, but in terms of future, of how they can make nuclear the mainstay of the entire energy supply. So just to give you an example, so that was the good part. The bad part from the climate change perspective is that looking into the future, the next two decades, really there are not many options for India besides coal. India is trying to do solar and nuclear, but the deployment the next...
Does it have nuclear technology now? Does it have the ability and the financing to do nuclear now?
The big holdup, it has technology. The big holdup is fuel supply, and that is what a lot of the discussions...
Uranium.
Uranium. And India doesn't want to depend on uranium because domestic supplies of uranium are very limited. So India has this plan of 1, 2, 3. They want to do uranium, thorium, and then they want to move on to fast breeder plutonium. And that is what India's own plans are because of energy security concerns. They don't want to be dependent on an international fuel system. They want to have the control themselves.
So they got lots of coal. It's not going to last them a really long time, but it's the only really low-hanging fruit. Solar, other sources can't scale up fast enough to make a dent in coal.
The next two decades, yes. Yeah. So then we come to the point of, so what do you do? And the answer there is really efficiency of coal plants. So just to give you an idea, India's average efficiency of coal plants right now is 30%. China is a little higher. United States is about 36-37%. Europe is about 38-39%. Now, moving forward...
So that means that say it's 40%. That means 40% of the actual energy is captured and 60% is lost,
lost as heat. And yeah. Those are because of thermodynamic limitations and what you can do with the energy in the coal.
Okay.
Now, moving forward... From a climate change perspective, what you want to do is build as efficient coal plants as you want. And not only in India, but anywhere in the world. China has been doing that very aggressively. They have been building supercritical. But looking into the next decade, they are building more and more ultra supercritical, which are very efficient, 45-46% efficient plants.
But what about the carbon? Are they looking at carbon capture and sequestration? I know you do research in that area.
Yes, and that's a more of... A futuristic.
Yeah, the U.S. isn't. No one's done that effectively, really. At scale.
Yes, there are several demonstration projects going around the world. But you know, to have a discussion on CCS, it's a lot more, you know, what's and ifs question. It's a lot more about technology and financing. But I want to come back to the question of efficiency of coal plants.
Okay.
And that is where China has been very aggressive. India is becoming more aggressive, not because of climate change concerns, but because I mentioned before, it has limitations in terms of coal supply, not only in terms of the volumes of coal, but also how fast it can produce it. And that is why they want to use it as efficiently as possible, which means they want to burn it as efficiently as possible, which is good news for climate. So moving forward, I think what has really changed in the last 1 year in India is this outlook of what they want to build in terms of coal power plants. And the change has been very positive. Moving forward, they really want to build as much supercritical as they want, as they can.
And you mentioned financing. So, Alexis, looking at capital inflows, is there a lot of venture capital flowing to startups in clean tech startups in India, or are they looking for are they cash starved because of the financial crisis?
Yeah, I definitely see a huge momentum, especially among the both the Silicon Valley VC firms as well as the Indian ones, to set up offices over there and look at the clean tech companies, not only in energy, but also in water, because water is a huge challenge, which is also related to climate change. But there's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a clean tech incubator that just got launched at one of the IIMs at Ahmedabad. And entrepreneurs are definitely coming together, forming groups with the Indus entrepreneurs, and forming kind of networks, especially at universities, and forming, trying to link up with the VC world.
I heard recently that some Silicon Valley VCs did a list of, say, top 20 companies in batteries, top 20 in solar, top 20 in wind, and there's very few U.S. companies in there. General Electric might be the one. There's several Chinese companies. What are the leaders in India, and what are the hot sectors?
In India, for existing companies, I mean, wind, you know, you have your traditional large-scale groups, you know, you have your Suzlon, and in solar, you have your Moser Bear. Among the entrepreneurs, those are still kind of emerging, and I think there's some exciting things happening in water. I think also in biogas. There's a whole group of entrepreneurs coming up there, and also in green buildings, green building materials in particular.
Is biogas meaning like methane from landfill, or what is bio?
Yeah, methane from landfill, methane from cow dung. I think that's a good traditional source, and it's not even just in technology innovations. I think that there's business model innovations for providing access to renewable energy, which I think is something that's very exciting among some of the startups. It's not only just the next gadget that comes up, but also how do they deliver and provide these services, linking up with microfinance institutions, for small scale lending, small scale loans, and how do they reach out to those remote areas that are showing some innovation?
And I'm on biomass. There's what, ABC? What does that stand for? The cloud. A lot of people use wood and other biomass, basically burning wood for heating and for fuel. So are there some low tech solutions here where that could be replaced by? Dr. Pachauri has, and then others have sort of their solar stoves or their solar lanterns, so that we can kind of work it from the bottom up, as well as nuclear plants are obviously take many years, billions of dollars.
Yeah. So ABC stands for atmospheric brown clouds, mm-hmm. and recent research has shown that these are soot particles or carbon particles that hang around low in the air, and research
is that black carbon?
Black carbon, yeah. yes. And I said carbon black, yes, mm-hmm. it's black carbon. And so these lead to net warming effect. Now, recent research has also shown that 2/3 of that comes from fuel wood cook stoves in houses, because most of the rural areas in India use these things. And there is a very strong correlation between atmospheric brown cloud and fuel wood burning in India. Now, the solutions are definitely not high-tech. These are questions about business models and also getting advanced cook stoves, which are efficient cook stoves, that are also consistent, for example, with cultural preferences for cooking.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So these are things, and for example, China has had a very, very successful cook stove distribution program where they have distributed about 100 million cook stoves. We did the calculation for India. If you could distribute 60 million of these advanced cook stoves, and these advanced cook stoves is some cook stove that will arrive at some point, if you could distribute about 60 million of that, then that could lead to climate change benefits of about 200 million tons CO2 per year. So that's equivalent to what I mentioned earlier about efficiency gains from the grid efficiency.
Right.
So these are large numbers and not very high-tech solutions. It's about actually getting together and doing it. I think India, certainly this is something that India has tried to do for a long time now, not again because of climate change benefits, but because of its rural and poverty-related programs. But now the climate change angle is also coming onto it in India. There is international pressure and attention, and India is also trying to get its hand around this problem.
Well, is it something that India would reach its hand in, the government would reach its hand into its pocket to pay for, or would that have to be some kind of business model where people would sell these things, or would they be given by the government?
I think there's both opportunity and a need for both of these parts. So India will certainly do it because it's a big part of their poverty reduction program or lifting rural livelihoods, but there is also scope for business models, perhaps including programmatic clean development mechanism funding. There is good opportunity for that as well. It fits very well with both these types of fundings.
Mentioned water, and I want to touch on that before we close, because people are increasingly aware and concerned about the melting of the Tibetan Glacier, the Tibetan Plateau, and how that feeds many of the rivers in Asia that supply water for agriculture and subsistence in China and India. And is this really on the sort of popular consciousness yet in terms of what that's going to mean to daily livelihood when snow melt and those rivers declines, and what the economic and political consequences might be downstream?
I think it is certainly not on the popular radar. It is on the radar of the top people. It is on the radar of top policymakers. Really, the people on a day-to-day basis are aware of the consequences. There are increasing occurrences of floods and droughts in India. So people are aware of the effects, not necessarily what's causing them or what's mm-hmm. going to happen down the line. Water is a very serious issue, not just in India, in many other parts of the world. And Alexis mentioned that it's another area that is receiving attention. Unfortunately, I do not think something very serious still on the road. That is something where I think it is headed in the direction of crisis in India. And
Tim Flannery, who's head of the Copenhagen Climate Council, a group of business people and government people and academics, spoke recently about gave quite a stern warning about it. If Copenhagen fails, there'll be resource wars within 10 years. And he was talking about water and other things. And I don't think just particularly in China and India, but other places where we'll start to see, and many people would argue, you were already seeing in Africa and elsewhere, that water is what's the saying, that, you know, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting, that we're going to see some fighting over water. Not to be too dire about this, but it's not hard to convey images of cross-border conflicts, particularly where tensions are already high, China, India, Pakistan, where water kind of tips the balance and things get kind of... So is that... Have you heard discussions about that? Is that on the...
And you don't have to wait for, you know, full effects of climate change to make the resource and water wars true. Yeah. You know, in many parts of India, and I grew up in a village, and I've seen what water really means for these people. First of all, electricity is free. So the farmers are pumping diesel pumps to bring out water. There are parts of India where the water level is decreasing 1 meter or even at higher paces. The water level depth is decreasing at that fast level. So it is really getting to a very bad tipping point. And I do not see... that as an unrealistic scenario of water resource wars.
Alexis, let's finish on a happy note about entrepreneurialism, and I don't want to end on a downbeat on water. Are you encouraged by the entrepreneurs and also the young people that you've seen? I think it was quite impressive that you were working with the Indian Youth Climate Network. There's obviously a group of how big is that group and how energized are they around this issue?
Yeah, the Indian Youth Climate Network started last year, over a year and a half ago, of just, you know, a collection of a handful, less than five people, and now is numbers in the hundreds of thousands of people who've joined the network. And they've already, you know, they're taking part in the government delegations that go to the Copenhagen and to Poznan last year. They have a voice. They were invited to submit their ideas, their position to the parliament in India. And so people are listening. Members of parliament are listening, and the government is listening. So I'm inspired by everything that they're doing. And they're a mass that is mobilizing. They recognize that this is, you know, an important issue on climate change, but it's about their energy security. It's about their local environment. It's about future business opportunities. And so for them, this is an exciting and very important issue. Entrepreneurs I see both in India and also in the U.S., a lot of now U.S. trade missions led by the Department of Commerce that are heading over to India to look at opportunities, meet with business partners there, meet policymakers to understand how can we promote this U.S.-India clean tech collaboration, which I think even perhaps more than or more quickly than climate negotiations may be a sign that, you know, maybe we can move forward progressively. Once you have business interests and companies and entrepreneurs sharing ideas and putting up projects in both countries, then you get to see some real action. So I'm hopeful. I see a lot of things happening, and entrepreneurs are definitely moving forward in both places.
So the youth and the entrepreneurs will positive note. Varun, any last comments?
Sure. I just want to add to what Alexis said, and this ties back to one of the first things that you asked: has there been a softening of stance by India? Mm-hmm. And you know, these delegations from the U.S. and other parts of the world going and connecting with the business people, connecting with the youth, connecting at the grounds level, I think that has been a really successful strategy that the world has followed in engaging developing countries rather than just negotiating between the prime ministers and the president. What you are seeing really is a much broader...
citizen diplomacy?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that is, you know, now the policymakers are not just thinking, it's not just a one-way... dialogue where they assume that they're representing their populi. In fact, now the populi is starting to interact with them, and they find that their the civil society there cares more about the environment than they had thought. So that has been a really good progress.
We had a program here at Climate One a while ago on the Copenhagen ad campaign, which is being rolled out. It's created by some advertising agency on Madison Avenue at the request of the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. And one of their taglines is lead the leaders, is exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. need to kind of bring the leaders along because the people are out front of the leaders in this case.
And that was the point of our road tour, is really to document the most exciting things that were happening across the country of India. Both there are, you know, a group of Americans and a group of Indian from the Indian Youth Climate Network, but it was to show these innovations not only to the Indian government so that they felt hopeful and, you know, reminded about the things that are happening in their own country, but to show it to the world and make India more accessible as a place for entrepreneurs and young people to link up and ideas to kind of share and open up these opportunities for collaboration, which will hopefully, you know, be leading the leaders.
There we go. And on that, I'd like to thank Alexis Ringwald, co-founder of Valence Energy and a former Fulbright scholar in India, and Varun Rai, who's a research fellow on the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. I'm Greg Dalton, and thanks for listening to Climate One.